I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On March 26th, a massive Maersk container ship crashed into the 1.6-mile-long Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, causing it to collapse into the river at 1:30 in the morning. Eight construction workers were on the bridge in the middle of the night filling potholes. Two survived and six died. They were all low-income immigrant workers in their 20s, 30s, and 40s from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico. Most of the men were married and had families. This tragic piece of the story got a lot of media attention because it is usually immigrants doing this kind of work, whether it's working on the infrastructure of this country or working on the front lines during COVID. And yet, they are vilified by Donald Trump and many of his supporters, and those horrible remarks are often repeated by so many in the major media. Within hours of the bridge collapse, The Guardian's Darna Noor was on the ground getting responses from community members. She spoke with Jesus Campos, a construction worker for the company Bronner Builders. He said the workers supported their family members here and abroad. Darna Noor also reports that the Key Bridge had become an emblem of Baltimore's staunch working class history, providing a route to jobs at plants and warehouses on the city's harbor. It overlooked the city's port, which handled 50 million tons of cargo last year and directly supports 15,000 jobs. Last year, Baltimore's port handled about $80 billion of cargo, moving between the U.S. and other countries. 8,000 people will be out of work until it reopens, an estimated $2 million in lost wages every day. Darna Noor is a fossil fuels and climate reporter with The Guardian U.S., and she lives in Baltimore. Hi, Darna. Thank you so much for your important reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Always great to be here.
We're also joined by Lucy Dean Stockton, news editor at The Lever, a nonpartisan, reader-supported investigative news outlet that holds accountable the people and corporations manipulating the levers of power. Lucy Dean Stockton and her colleagues report that Maersk was recently sanctioned by regulators for blocking its employees from directly reporting safety concerns to the U.S. Coast Guard in violation of a Seaman Whistleblower Protection Law. According to regulatory filings, Maersk, which is headquartered in Copenhagen, is one of the world's largest shipping companies, reporting more than $51 billion in revenue last year. Lucy Dean Stockton also reports that days after the collision, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Larry Hogan called for the federal government to foot the bill for the bridge's reconstruction. Hogan's demand follows his efforts as Maryland's governor to attract such outsized cargo vessels to Baltimore's port, despite safety warnings from an insurance giant and transportation expert. Hogan did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Hi, Lucy. Thank you so much to you and your colleagues for all of your important reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose, for having me. And I'm also looking forward to sharing a new report that came out just a few days ago.
Great.
That is
well, thank you
as well. Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Well, as we always do on our media roundtables, we start the show by highlighting a good piece of journalism. So, Darna, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
I mean, it was really a harrowing week, I would say. As you mentioned, I live in Baltimore, and so I was simultaneously getting texts from all around the country, people asking if I was safe. You know, this was, as you said, the bridge collapse happened at 1:30 in the morning. So upon waking up really early, I got all these texts. And so by the time that I started reporting, I didn't really have all that much information about, you know, who was on the bridge, how many drivers were on the bridge, who was impacted, which was pretty scary. And I think that a lot of people were in that position. A lot of people were feeling a lot of panic and anxiety in the hours after the collapse. And of course, you know, the tragedy of the six workers who were killed by this bridge collapse is just awful. You know, they were working overnight fixing potholes on the bridge to, you know, ensure that people have a smooth ride to work. And that's how they perish, which is just awful. Mm. And so a lot of what I heard was, you know, obviously mourning for those folks, but also, you know, concerns about traffic, concerns about the economy, and really mourning the bridge again as a symbol as well.
I have to say, Darna, I don't want to say glad, but it was good to see so many media outlets focusing on the six immigrant workers. Again, to think about them filling potholes while people are sleeping to get ready to go to work the next day. I mean, and a number of major media outlets have done a good job of talking about how, yes, it's immigrants who tend to do a lot of these jobs. Let's remember what happened during COVID. And yet they are so vilified by Trump and many of his supporters. And as I said in the intro, media really need to think about how they're going to deal with how ugly this election. Well, it's already been ugly, but it's probably going to get uglier in the months to come.
Yeah. I mean, I was also really heartened to see so much media drawing attention to, you know, the role of immigrant workers in our country. You know, non-union construction is still one of the most dangerous professions in the country. But I mean, as you're sort of alluding to here, there was also another segment of media, the sort of far right, that immediately sprung to these wild conclusions about how the bridge collapse was somehow tied to our overly open border policies. There were folks who were essentially basically saying that the fact of the bridge collapse was somehow tied to the fact that we have a black mayor. There was the term DEI mayor was thrown around. And so, you know, I think there's been a real divide where there's definitely also been a segment of the media who's just used this as a way to inject a really racist narrative into this horrible story.
Mm. And you said non-union. So for listeners who haven't been following this closely, these immigrant workers were working for a non-union contractor called Bronner Builders, and they contract with the state of Maryland. Is that right?
That's right, which I think, I mean, it's another issue that we should really be drawing attention to is the idea that states are allowed to contract with non-union contract firms in the first place.
Right. What about you, Lucy? What really caught your attention this week?
I mean, I do. I think there was so much valuable reporting, both on the bridge. I did come upon some good news, which was unrelated, but was just really pleased to see it. I think it is related in that it's very much related to working conditions and public infrastructure. Earlier this week, the Department of Transportation and the Federal Railroad Administration announced that all freight and passenger trains would need to have a minimum of 2 crew members. It's a really important part of making sure that there's not another disaster like East Palestine. But I think specifically as it relates to this incident that happened again this week or last week, I thought it was so valuable to see any reporting on these workers, immigrant workers who like perished in this bridge collapse, and also the fact that it will probably be many immigrant workers rebuilding the bridge. You know, I think like these workers are so, so important to our economy. And I was really heartened to see that there was really good, genuine reporting talking about the workers, the complex remittances that they have, and as well as just like their stories and how important this is to everyone that, that this affects.
Right. Darna, do you know if once workers start to rebuild the bridge, and as Lucy said, so many of them will be immigrants, will those be union jobs?
I mean, I've not seen a lot of conversation around this aspect of this horror as yet. I hope, honestly, that is not the case. And I think it's really something that, you know, where the state of Maryland could see some real pressure. I hope to see that build.
Mm. Well, again, it's so important to point out that these were 6 people who worked so hard in the middle of the night, helping their families here in the U.S., and then their home countries. And it's just important to recognize that. We've got a video up of a news outlet remembering them. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Darna, right when this happened, like I said, you went to the communities near the bridge to talk to people. And what really struck me about your reporting is that so many people are saying, you know, we are going to take care of each other, but we're tired of doing this. Tired of doing this because the government isn't doing it, whether it means ensuring that people have food, ensuring that people have a place to stay, launching GoFundMe campaigns for these families. Can you talk about what struck you about the conversations you had?
I mean, I think it was really just that. I was really inspired and really moved to see the way that so many communities pulled together in the wake of the disaster. You know, immediately seeing GoFundMes, as you said, go up, which raised something like $100,000 in just 6 hours for the families of the victims. You know, unions immediately sort of getting on board to not only advocate for protections for their own workers, but also to, again, help out the families of the victims. Everything down to, you know, folks who are sending food to first responders, and again, the victims' families. And I think that was really beautiful to see that. But as you're sort of saying, I mean, I hate to think that that's the version of a social safety net that we have to rely on. I think that there's no reason, especially in a case like this, where the state certainly bears at least some responsibility for taking care of the victims here. I hate to see that it's, you know, these small nonprofit advocacy groups or grassroots folks that are having to sort of fill those gaps. I also just want to note that, you know, there were actually two workers who were on the bridge who, you know, fell into the water and then were saved. One of them was immediately rushed to the hospital, but another one declined medical attention. And we don't know for sure, but the sort of idea from folks in the community is that he might have lacked health insurance. He may have even lacked immigration status. And so that means that, you know, you're going to be less likely to seek care, to turn down care that's offered, which is just really, it's an awful fact about our healthcare system.
Mm. That's such an important point. We have a question from Ruby who says, were the workers wearing life jackets? Does anyone know if they were? Darn it, any idea?
It's a great question, and I don't believe that they were. But actually, that's a good place to follow up.
It really is. Lucy?
Yeah, I also want to add a note about the accountability and what comes next. So earlier this week, the Lever also reported that there's a pretty complex web of liability issues at play. The Dali, the ship that ran into the bridge, was managed by a management company called Synergy. It was chartered by Maersk, the second largest shipping company in the world, but it was owned by a pretty private company called Grace Ocean Private Limited, which is based in the British Virgin Islands, a known tax haven. And we found this week that Grace Ocean is actually invoking a 173-year-old law to cap the damages that they're responsible for. So they're trying to pay just $43 million, which is the cost of cargo and the vessel. And it's a tenth of the $400 million required to rebuild the bridge. And it doesn't offer any compensation for the families of the six workers who lost their lives. Again, I think this is a really important question about like where accountability matters for these corporate actors and what happens when Hogan immediately jumps to calling for the federal government to pay for the bridge reconstruction, knowing now that Grace Ocean has already filed in court that they won't be paying more than 10%.
Wow. Lucy, we have time for this. So can you walk us through this? Because we all see these massive ships. If we live near a port or we live near the ocean, we see these ships, but most people have no idea how this web works. So we've also seen that massive Maersk, M-A-E-R-S-K, on a lot of the vessels. Can mm-hmm. you just kind of walk us through this? You mentioned Synergy Marine Group, Grace Ocean Private Limited. I'm sure most people have never heard of these companies.
Yeah, no, there's a lot at play. These ships have doubled in size since 1980. Just between 1996 and 2015, they doubled in size. And if stood upright, the Dali, again, the ship that ran into the bridge, would reach almost to the top of the Eiffel Tower. So they're just enormous. They have different infrastructural needs. They need deeper channels. They need wider turning radiuses, bigger berths, stronger docks, higher cranes for unloading. And throughout the 2010s, there was actually a race among cities on the East Coast to attract these new mega ships and the economic activity that they would bring. Baltimore, which is the closest port to the Midwest, actually really invested in this. And by 2017, they were just one of four East Coast ports that could handle these mega ships. I think it's important to note that these mega ships were largely driven by the bottom line for corporations. So the bigger that the ships are, the less fuel has to be spent per container to transport goods. And so Maersk is really interested in shipping their goods on these huge mega ships. But it also means that for the ports that are receiving them, there are all of these different considerations that they need to be doing, including thinking about their bridges and their bridge infrastructure. And I can talk a little bit about how other cities fortified their bridges, but I'll also just say, shipping is a huge industry. And I think unless you live near a port, like it's unlikely that you'll see these huge ships, right? Mm-hmm. We're much more likely to see box trucks moving around after they're unloaded. But I think it's like It's notable that the size of these ships growing was driven by corporate interest, and that all of these cities then had to invest millions and millions of dollars in dredging their bay, in dredging their ports and accommodating larger vessels. Some cities even rebuilt their bridges so they would be taller, like in New York and in Long Beach.
And to add more to this, as you report, so this ship was chartered by Maersk. Again, they reported $51 billion in revenue last year, the world's largest shipping company, operated by Synergy Marine Group, a ship management company based in Singapore. The boat is owned by Grace Ocean Private Limited and was headed to Sri Lanka. So based on, you know, people you've interviewed, who should be held responsible for this?
It's a really good question. Actually, I don't think we'll really know until there are like closer investigations and until there's some sort of legal action. But the fact that Grace Ocean is, I mean, I do think it's important to know also, right? So Synergy was managing the boat. It was Maersk chartering the boat and their goods being shipped on it. And it was, it's owned by Grace Ocean, which isn't necessarily operating it. So it's like, it is hard to place blame. That's true. But I think it's notable that Grace Ocean is already trying to shirk responsibility. And they're using this really old law from 1851, which is sometimes called the Titanic Law, because it was actually invoked when the Titanic sank. It left the owners of the Titanic on the hook for very little compensation to the families of the victims who died. And the last notable time that it was invoked was in 2010, after the BP Gulf oil spill, which remains, of course, one of the greatest environmental tragedies in American history. At that time, the shipping company responsible for the spill tried to pay just $26 million, and they ended up on the hook for $1.4 billion. There were some reform attempts made, but they were stymied by pushback from the shipping industry, oil and gas, and even Disney, which owns a number of cruise lines. I think it's important to know, like, these are really complex international corporations, and so it is going to be difficult to hold them accountable. But I was just telling a friend the other day that you would think that if you break it, you buy it. But in this case, with this law, if a corporation breaks it, the public is likely to just buy it again. Hmm.
Lucy Dean Stockton is a news editor at The Lever. Darna Noor is a reporter with The Guardian US. Darna lives in Baltimore. If you have any questions or comments for our guests about their reporting and what happened on the Baltimore Bridge and this web of these shipping companies that we're learning about, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Darna, how are these companies covered in Maryland in the press there? Are you able to get answers about some of these questions that Lucy is raising?
I mean, I have to say, I think that, as you sort of alluded to, the fact that folks really just see the name Maersk on the ship, I think, does a lot of work to really hide this vast, complex network that The Lever has been uncovering so crucially. I think that there are so many people in Baltimore who, you know, just sort of look at the ships and think of them as like a symbol of the booming economy there and a symbol of, you know, prosperity at the harbor, and don't really think too much about, you know, the ways that those ships were actually brought there. But I do think that, you know, there will be a lot more attention now, you know, in the state house, at the city level, at the federal level, obviously, too, to really, you know, ensure that disasters like this don't happen again, and to ensure that the complex webs of responsibility here are something that we can untangle.
Right. Well, Lucy, you also report that in 2021, Maersk spent almost $3 million lobbying Congress and federal regulators on workers' compensation, as well as port congestion and infrastructure issues, among other concerns. $3 million is not a lot for a company that makes $51 billion in revenue in 1 year. Have you heard from any members of Congress who are going to investigate this company or any of the others?
I haven't heard from them yet. But, I mean, I do think it's notable. Maersk is joined by many other shipping companies and major corporations in spending millions lobbying our lawmakers. And it was notable that Maersk was lobbying on workers' compensation, because the year before, they had actually been sanctioned by the Department of Labor for another incident on another boat that they were chartering and managing. Wherein they basically were suppressing a whistleblower. They broke a workplace protection law, and they created a culture of unsafety with company policy that requires employees to report concerns to Maersk, the company, before reporting safety concerns to the Coast Guard. I think that, of course, in lobbying disclosures, there is always a certain amount of obfuscation. It's difficult to know what companies are saying to our lawmakers, what the lobbyists specifically are talking about or angles. And often that isn't revealed until months or even years later when we get handed the bills and the political consequences of that lobbying. But I do think it's notable that they were lobbying on that.
Right. And when I said that's not a lot, you often see that these corporations get so much for pennies. Right. I mean, they'll give some Congress people $100,000 here and there, and yet they get so much as a result of that. The other piece, Lucy, that you and your colleagues wrote about was Larry Hogan, a Maryland's former Republican governor who's now running for Senate. You report that the Hogan administration's major public-private partnership to attract these mega ships promised that it, quote, reduces the occurrences of crashes, fatalities, and injuries among transportation users. Hogan appointed the head of dredging contractors lobbying group to run the port amid the much celebrated expansion that doled out lucrative dredging and construction contracts. And this came as the insurance conglomerate Alliance was spotlighting the dangers of large cargo ships. So can you tell us more about what you have learned?
Yeah, absolutely. Throughout the 2010s, like I said, Baltimore was interested in retrofitting their ports to compete for these mega ships that could now travel through the expanded Panama Canal. And Hogan was really a champion of them. He believed in the economic activity that they would bring. And we found that during his major port expansion projects from 2017 to 2021, which cost millions of dollars and also including federal dollars, he neglected to, I think, prioritize other safety concerns. And he actually said that many of the proposals and the new expanded projects would have few mitigated risks. The 2018 major proposal didn't make adjustments or designate protections for the nearby Key Bridge, even at the same time that he was boasting that they were seeing larger and larger container ships. And I think it's relevant that Alliance warned against the ships, the insurance conglomerate, and the size, how their size growth raised risk management concerns for the ports where they'd be docking. But so did the International Transport Forum, which is actually a body related to the UN. They warned not only that these ships were dangerous, but they also recommended bridge updates, and they also explicitly warned cities against using public money to retrofit the ports. They found that it led to situations where the public sector was picking up the bill of the costs imposed by shipping lines and were skeptical that it really paid off. Hogan, though, I think was willing to do it. And I mean, Darna might know just as much about this, but during his tenure as governor, he really claimed to have an open for business agenda. Now running for the Senate, he has a common slogan about let's get back to work. He's really a pro-business Republican, and he's currently running for a Democrat-controlled seat.
Darna, what would you like to add?
I think, yes, really important, as Lucy said, to note his, explicitly sort of taking cues from business attitude as governor. He's also had a pretty difficult, let's say, track record on many labor protections. You know, he's vetoed several collective bargaining measures from AFSCME that would have expanded and consolidated collective bargaining rights in Maryland campuses, in city halls. He's generally been a pretty big opponent of labor, opponent of many, you know, sort of business regulations, and a real friend to, you know, those in the shipping industry, those looking to bring more business into the port at all costs. And so I think to think of him in another position after this could be pretty frightening for many issues.
We don't have time to take callers, but we have a number of questions. I'm wondering, Darna, if you know the answer to this. One caller said, we hear traffic was stopped by cops who heard the SOS message, but how did the workers not know the boat was about to hit the bridge? Why weren't they warned?
a lot of questions about this. I don't think we know the answer to why they weren't warned. I think it really speaks to the need for, you know, a better emergency response systems for workers, especially those who are working overnight in such dangerous jobs.
And Michelle in Oakland wants to know, was the bridge poorly built to begin with?
Depends who you ask. There are engineers who sort of say if a cargo ship of that size had hit any bridge, you know, it definitely would have destroyed it. On the other hand, the idea that you should be able to have, as Lucy said, these massively expanding and very quickly expanding ships next to a bridge that can't take that kind of hit is really, really terrifying.
Well, we'll continue definitely to cover this issue. Thank you both for your reporting. Darna Noor is a fossil fuels and climate reporter at The Guardian. She lives in Baltimore. Within hours of the bridge collapse, she was on the ground getting responses from community members. Lucy Dean Stockton is a news editor at The Lever. She and her team have done really important reporting about Maersk sanctioning. Maersk was recently sanctioned by regulators for blocking its employees from directly reporting safety concerns to the U.S. Coast Guard. And then they have that piece about Republican U.S. Senate candidate Larry Hogan. Darna and Lucy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will discuss media coverage of the ongoing U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza, which has now killed over 33,000 Palestinians. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.